Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. We're so happy to have our friend Crystal Pico Watanabe as a sponsor of the show. Crystal is one of the best editors in the business, and she has just debuted a new service that I think you'll absolutely love and will help you to up your writing game. Pico's School of Wordcraft and Editing has just debuted, and the first course is called Properly Punctuating Dialogue. It's a mini course and can be completed in just about 20 minutes. It covers the basics of dialogue punctuation. Authors can get access to the new school and the course for free by signing up for Crystal's author newsletter, Notes from Pico. Go to picoshouse.com/newsletters. That's PIKKOSHOUSE.com/newsletters. More in-depth courses will be added in 2020. Make sure you don't miss a thing. PicosHouse.com/newsletters. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2 are only 99 cents for a limited time. The gods are rightfully imprisoned, and Cess intends to keep them that way. But her terrorist father has other plans. Gregory D. Little's Unwilling Souls is a pulse-pounding chase through an epic fantasy world of adventure, sinister conspiracy, and a magical industrial revolution fueled by harvested human souls. Cess is the daughter of powerful parents who would very much like to kill one another and who therefore pretend she doesn't exist. An apprentice jailer of the gods, Cess spends her days learning to forge the tools needed to maintain the gods' prison. When her terrorist father attacks the prison on her 16th birthday, Cess is forced to flee after the secret of her parentage is revealed. Suddenly on the wrong side of the law, Cess realizes the very father who abandoned her may be the only one who can protect her. But some secrets are darker than parentage. On her way to find her father, Cess will uncover truths about her family and herself that will shatter her understanding of the world and risk the return of the gods themselves. Unwilling Souls and its sequel, Ungrateful God, are on sale now for only 99 cents. The third book of the series is coming early next year, so now is the perfect time to get up to speed. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2, only 99 cents for a limited time. Writers, I have an amazing tool to tell you about. A revolutionary writing tool for planning stories, Campfire Pro, is what novelists need to go from the seed of an idea to a detailed plan that's ready to be executed. Complete your character design, create a timeline, and track your world building all in one place with our downloadable desktop app for Mac and PC, without the annoying subscription model so many apps are using today. Visit campfiretechnology.com for special holiday pricing on Campfire Pro today. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Bruce Steele on the show with me today. He has a fantastic new book. It's called One Day at Disney, Meet the People Who Make the Magic Across the Globe. And let me tell you what, this book is incredible. Welcome to the show, Bruce.
Thanks for having me on.
Bruce, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, it's a little embarrassing, but I used to write stories for my stuffed animals.
Nice.
I had a Polaroid camera. I had a Polaroid camera back when I was, 10 or 12, and I would pose my stuffed animals in dramatic poses and then take photos of them and write stories to go with the pictures.
That's actually really amazing. I love that. Were you a bookish kid growing up?
I was. I had a library. I had 3x5 cards where I kept track of all of my books. I had a coding system, and I had a secret page where I put the code for every book on that page so that I knew it was my book. Yeah, I was seriously into books.
That's amazing. Do you remember if there was a book, an author, or a series that really just kind of lit the fire of your imagination?
Well, I read a lot of science fiction when I was a teenager, and I really loved the works of Isaac Asimov. And he was still alive at the time, and most amazingly, I finally got to actually meet him in person at a book fair in New York City when I guess I was in my 30s. And he was there signing books, and it was just an amazing experience to meet the man who had shaped my teenage years so much.
Oh, wow. Did he have those glorious lamb chops at the time when you got to meet him?
He did. He was a hairy guy. Big brain, sideburns, and fuzzy hair, and the big glasses, the whole thing.
Oh, that's fantastic. It's always kind of surreal when you get to meet your heroes. I hope it was a good experience.
He was a great guy. I had actually sent him a fan letter some years earlier, and he had responded with a postcard that said, thank you for your letter. I try to respond to all of my fans, but only one. hint. But he'd signed that. I still have that postcard. It's really amazing.
Love it. So what did you decide to do career-wise after school?
Well, I fell in love with periodical writing when I was in school. I wrote for the school newspaper. I started by writing movie reviews, and then I would do entertainment interviews and profiles. And that's eventually what I went into after I graduated from college at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. I went and got a job at a daily newspaper in Alexandria, Louisiana, called the Alexandria Daily Town Talk, still there. And it was a great job because it was a section called the Special Sections Department, and we got to write about everything from crawfish farmers to businessmen to entertainment. It was an all-around kind of feature reporter job, and I found that I love telling other people's stories, and that's what I've been doing for most of my career.
Wow. What brought you to the University of Alabama?
I grew up in Michigan, but my father's job was transferred to Alabama when I was a senior in high school, and since my parents were going to live in Alabama, I went to the university.
Nice. So falling in love with periodicals and writing short form like that, what was your major in college?
I majored in English, but I think my most important experiences in college were working for the school newspaper, and then I worked on a magazine that a friend of mine co-founded when I was a senior, and so I was working on both the newspaper and the magazine, and then my career has been in both newspapers and magazines.
Wow. What types of things have you been writing for magazines and newspapers?
Well, I eventually went into the editorial jobs. And I was the executive editor and one of the founding editors of a magazine called Out Magazine, which we founded in 1992 in New York. It was the first kind of glossy gay and lesbian feature magazine on the style of kind of GQ or Esquire, and worked on that from 1992 until 1999. And then I moved over to The Advocate, which was the gay and lesbian biweekly news magazine founded in 1967. It's still around today, and I became editor-in-chief there. So I did a lot of editing in my career, but I would also get to save some of the big stories for myself, which was nice.
Nice. You also got an MFA in film studies, didn't you?
I did. Actually, just before I went to Out Magazine, I had decided that I didn't really want to be in Louisiana anymore. I wasn't really a fan of the 9-month summers. So I'd always idolized the movies of Woody Allen back when Woody Allen was something different than he is today. And
right.
So I moved myself to Manhattan and went to Columbia University in their MFA program for film studies. And I got an MFA in film studies. But my concentration was the writing side, the history theory criticism side.
So at what point does this love of working in media and film criticism and all of the things that you had done converge with a love for Disney?
Well, we we've been a Disney family since the 1990s. My husband, Christopher Oakley, was a Disney animator from about 1996 till 2001, largely on a computer animated movie, Disney's first in-house computer animated movie back before they bought Pixar, called Dinosaur. Came out in the year 2000. So I was a Disney husband and had a silver pass, and we lived in Los Angeles, and I could go down to Disneyland and take friends and get into the park for free anytime I wanted. So we've been a Disney family for going on 25 years now.
That's incredible. I remember taking our oldest son to see Dinosaur when he was 4 or 5, I guess, when it came out. And that was such groundbreaking work at the time. It was amazing.
Well, what's kind of remarkable is that my husband Christopher worked on animating the lemurs in the movie, the little monkeys. God forbid I should actually call them monkeys, because they're not monkeys, they're lemurs.
Right, right.
And then while I'm writing, one day at Disney, one of the cast members, as Disney calls their employees, one of the cast members featured in the book is an animal keeper who specializes in lemurs.
Oh, wow. That had to be kind of a pretty cool full circle moment.
That was great. In fact, I just went down to Disney World last week and caught up with her. Her name is Chris Becker. She's been at Disney's Animal Kingdom almost since it opened. And yeah, I've got to watch her feed the lemurs and come over and talk to some of the guests about how lemurs live in the wild and the specific lemurs at the park and what their names are and how old they are and what their histories are. Really interesting stuff.
Yeah, no doubt. Because your husband works for Disney and is a cast member, as you said, did you think that you had a good understanding of kind of the workings of Disney? And I know you had to have learned an awful lot doing this book, but before the book, did you feel like that you were pretty well versed in the culture and how everything worked?
Well, I mean, one thing you know working for Disney, and I have to be honest, Christopher hasn't worked for Disney since 2001. He now teaches animation at the University of North Carolina in Asheville, where we live. But we've never lost touch with Disney, and so many of our friends continue to work for Disney. And what I was saying was the one thing you learn when you're close to Disney and working for Disney is that Disney really wants everything to be the best. It's not just a pose. It's not just something they say, it's something that they do and that they regiment and that they make sure genuinely happens. If it's not the best, it's not Disney. And that's so many of the people that I talked to for this book really emphasize how focused they are on the guest experience. Now, whether that means the guest experience for somebody who's watching ESPN or whether that means the guest experience in a park or in a restaurant, they really want to make sure that what they're doing is, it's a cliche to say, but it's true, is creating magic for the people who are the consumers.
Since the time that you guys were, really ingrained in Disney, the company has changed a lot since then and has really become this media powerhouse, even more so than they were at the time with, their acquisitions of ABC and the Marvel and Star Wars and all of that stuff. How'd you get the opportunity to do this book? Where did this idea come from? And what were some of the logistics behind just setting up the project itself, before going to the actually interviewing people? Just how did the book come about?
Well, the idea, as much as you may or may not believe it, the idea came from Bob Iger, the head of the company. I haven't spoken with him about how he decided to do this, but I imagine that since Bob travels the world and goes to all of these divisions of the company day by day and meets all these interesting people with interesting jobs, he thought it would be cool to share some of this information, some of these stories with everyone else through this book. So it took 3 or 4 years to put it together. I only got involved about a year ago, after a lot of work had gone into this already. The 75 to 80 cast members in the book had already been selected, and I'm sure that took tons of work. There are 4 pages in the back of the book that just thank people in the company who helped make it happen. And of course, the concept of the book was not only to talk to cast members, but was to shoot all of the hundreds of beautiful photographs in the book on one day. It is called One Day at Disney because all of the photographs were shot on one day, February 21st of this year. So that was quite a logistical challenge. There were a number of people who worked full-time on nothing but the logistics of making it happen.
So Bob Iger has the idea. How do you get plugged into this project?
Bob has the idea, and there was a gentleman in the corporate communications department who worked on the book, and an editor at the Disney publishing company that worked on the book. And the two of them and their teams put it together. I had been working for Disney on a freelance basis for their Disney 23 magazine, which is a big, fancy, glossy magazine that only goes out to members of the D23 fan club, which is Disney's in-house fan club. And for the D23 magazine, I had gone to places like the set of Mary Poppins Returns and gone out to Pixar to talk about Coco. And the nature of my writing for Disney 23 magazine was to talk to both celebrities like Emily Blunt and, you know, the behind-the-scenes people, the animators at Pixar. So I had been telling sort of cast member stories at all levels for several years. So when they put this book together, they thought of me as the person who could tell the cast member stories.
So on this day in March where you're going to visit all these cast members, take all the pictures, did the interviews with these people happen during that day as well?
Well, obviously it was February 21st. Obviously it would be impossible to talk to 80 people on one day. I thought the best place for me to be would be where there the most number of cast members would be. So I went down to Walt Disney World and spent two or three days down there visiting all the cast members at all the different theme parks and other enterprises down there who were in the book. And on the actual picture day, I was in the Magic Kingdom with a security host and a parade crowd control staffer. And who was the third? A third staff. Oh, the candy maker down there.
Nice. How do you prepare for something like this ahead of time?
Well,
for you, the writer, not the whole project, but how did you?
I think my whole life has been preparation for this, just because we have been so connected to Disney for so long. Both through my husband's job, through my freelance writing, through all of our friends who worked for the company. But mostly I've spent my career talking to people about what the people you're talking to think are ordinary things, but you know, as a writer, are not ordinary to everyone else in the world. And I think that's the realization you have to make as a writer, is that the people you're talking to don't understand how interesting they are. And it's your job as a writer to sort of bring that out.
So how did you kind of cover the logistics of this? You chose where the most people were. Did you have pre-selected questions that you used? What was kind of your preparation process for the interviews?
I did have two sets of questions that I started with for everybody. One set of questions for just everybody in general, and a separate set of questions for the 12 or so people who worked for the Imagineering division, because the Imagineers, as you probably know, are the people who invent and create and think up everything that goes in the parks and the resorts. And they have worked on tons of really interesting things. But the difficult part of speaking to the Imagineers is whatever they're working on at the moment you're speaking to them, they can't tell you about. So it was sort of a different list of questions, since most of them couldn't talk about what their job was on picture day on February 21st, but they could talk about things they'd worked on in the past. So they had a sort of a different set of questions. But I asked everybody, started everybody with the same questions, including Bob Iger, who wrote the foreword to the book, but also wanted to be included as a cast member. So he got on the phone just like everybody else, and I asked Bob Iger the same questions I ask everybody about how they got started and what they do for day to day and how their job works. And I got to ask Bob Iger to tell me what his favorite movie, theme park, attraction, or song was, which was something that we asked every cast member to supply. And he had to stop and think about it for a minute, because it's like picking among his children, I think. But he finally came up with the Pirates of the Caribbean attraction as his favorite Disney park attraction.
Were there any surprises for you as you go through talking to these people, or maybe discovering, you know, places and jobs at Disney that you weren't aware of? Was there at any point where you were just taken aback and surprised?
Well, the job that we keep talking about with folks about this book is a fellow named Tom Self. And Tom was a Navy guy, and when he was in the Navy, he was already a machinist, a mechanically inclined guy. When he was in the Navy, he learned basically how to fix every machine on a Navy ship, and he also went sort of recreationally scuba diving. And at one point, Disney needed a machinist who could go underwater and look at some of the equipment and the attractions that's underwater all the time. And Tom raised his hand and said, yeah, I can do that. And so that's what he does now. He goes to work at 11 o'clock or midnight every night that he's working. And he puts on his scuba gear and grabs his toolbox and jumps into the waters of the Jungle Cruise or the Finding Nemo submarine ride or Rivers of America, and goes down there and looks at the tracks on which the rides run, or, you know, pulling out debris that may have fallen in. Making sure that the hippos and the Jungle Cruise are working properly after 65 or 70 years.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's a job that who would know that there's a scuba diving machinist at Disneyland?
I sure didn't. That's incredible. You know, the sheer scope of Disney is impressive, to say the least. You know, when you're do you ever just, you know, walk around and go, my God, I'm so fortunate to get to help tell their story? That had to be especially for kind of a lifelong Disney fan like you.
Well, yeah. And as you mentioned, the company has grown so much just over the past 15 or 20 years. A lot of people, when we're talking about this book one day at Disney, think, oh, it's going to be a book about the theme parks. And yes, every theme park is in there, including Hong Kong and Shanghai and Tokyo and Paris. And of course, all the U.S. theme parks, they're all in there. But Disney also encompasses, you know, ESPN and ABC and Pixar and Marvel and Lucasfilm, and all of those folks are in there too. So we had photographers in at a basketball game in Minnesota. We had photographers at the ESPN headquarters in Connecticut. We had photographers in the Bahamas, where the Disney cruise ships stop at the Disney-owned island called Castaway Key. We sent a photographer to Costa Rica to catch up with a guy named Corey Amrine, who's a guide for Adventures by Disney, where he had a group of tourists on a Disney guided tour down in Costa Rica. So the scope of the company is just staggering, and the book only is, to use a cliche, the tip of an iceberg.
Right. Who were some of the most fun people that you got to meet and hear their stories? Do any stick out in your memory?
Well, I have to talk about a fellow named Mark Gonzalez, because my grandfather, I was born in Pennsylvania, and my grandfather worked in the Pennsylvania Railroad machine shop for his entire career in Altoona, Pennsylvania. So we are a railroad family going way back. And so I got to meet at Disneyland a fellow named Mark Gonzalez, who is an engineer on the Disneyland Railroad. And Mark told me his story. By the time he was 11 years old, Mark could tear apart and put back together a car engine by himself, with his father's support, of course, but doing it by himself. But when Mark would go to sleep at night, he could hear the Union Pacific Railroad down the street from him and the train whistles. And he really, really wanted to work on steam locomotives. And really, there's nowhere to work on steam locomotives on a daily basis anymore except Disneyland. And so when he was in college, he went and became a conductor, which are just the folks who let people on and off the trains. And eventually he got to actually be on the train staff and become, first you have to be a fireman. You have to spend 2 years learning how to work the boilers on the locomotives. And then eventually you get to become an engineer. And he's been doing that job now for 12 years. And he says he still feels like a beginner. But I bring up Mark because of my special relationship with the railroads. when I went to meet Mark in Disneyland, he said, meet me at the train station. So we met him at the train station, and the train pulls in, and there's, oh, you know, all the cars with all the tourists on them you're very familiar with. And then on the back of the train, you may or may not have noticed, there's a special enclosed car called the Lily Bell, named after Lillian Disney, Walt's wife. And the Lily Bell dates back to the opening of Disneyland. And it's a beautiful, fancy car. It looks like the inside looks like, you know, the Orient Express. And you wouldn't know what this car is for unless you got to be invited inside. And so we got to go once around the park on the Lillian Bell. And it was special, not just because it's the VIP car and it's exclusive and, you know, and it has that history. It was special because we were there with Mark, who was telling the stories of that train and telling the stories of the car and telling the stories of those locomotives in a way that really connects the present to the past. And some of the locomotives at Disneyland date back to 1896. So to be able to ride that train car that Walt Disney used to ride with a modern day engineer who understands the whole history of it, it was just an amazing experience.
What's so impressive to me is that for a company that is so forward thinking and forward looking, and you know, doing things with you know, with Pixar and different aspects of the company that are, you know, cutting edge technology, their love of history and the want and need to preserve that is stunning in a lot of ways.
Well, I mean, I can't tell you how many people, you know, reference Walt Disney in talking to me about their jobs, and like Mark, but also Joe Hernandez, who's in the book, is the one of the captains of the Mark Twain Riverboat at Disneyland, and the Mark Twain Riverboat, which was designed and built under the direct supervision of Walt Disney. The riverboat where Walt Disney and his wife Lillian had an anniversary party, a private anniversary party in the days before Disneyland opened in 1955. That's still the same riverboat that's traveling the rivers of America today. So, and obviously, you know, Mickey Mouse dates back to the founding of the company. And one of the people in the book is one of Disney's star animators named Eric Goldberg, who invented the genie for Robin Williams for the original Aladdin. And he is now one of the few people that is allowed to actually draw and animate Mickey Mouse for whenever he's needed, for whether it's TV animation or new features or park attractions. Eric either draws the mouse himself or supervises the folks who are drawing it to make sure that Mickey Mouse in 2019, 2020 is going to still look like the Mickey Mouse that Walt Disney would recognize.
Incredible. Incredible. The book, One Day at Disney, Meet the People Who Make the Magic Across the Globe. What an incredible book. It's, you know, it's this kind of coffee table book format, heavy, really beautiful paper that it's printed on. And each page that you open to, you know, is this kind of two-page spread with the interview on one side and the pictures on the other. And then, you know, there are other kind of photo galleries as you go through. You mentioned earlier that when you say One Day at Disney, people assume that you're talking about the theme parks, and I think that's a valid assumption for a lot of people. But what do you think will surprise most people about this book?
I think people will be surprised by the sheer scope of the company worldwide, and it's called One Day at Disney because it all happened on, all the photos were taken on one day, but that one day lasted about 40 hours because we started in Tokyo and then went all the way around the world and ended up in Hawaii. And by the time we got to Hawaii, it was already the next day in Tokyo. So as they say, the sun never sets on Disney. There's always somewhere somebody is enjoying a Disney experience. My favorite anecdote about that is I was on the phone at 7 o'clock in the morning in Asheville, North Carolina, talking to a woman named Kay Namiki, who's a stage manager of the parades at Disneyland Tokyo. And she was just ending her day, and I was just starting mine. And we were talking at 7 in the morning, and about 7:15, suddenly there was all this noise on the line, and I could barely hear what she was saying. And I said, I have to stop for a moment. There's all this noise on the line. I think it's on your end. Can you fix that? And they said, well, we may just have to wait because the fireworks are going off. And I'm thinking, here I am having my morning coffee in Asheville, North Carolina, and in Tokyo, they're watching the fireworks. It's the end of the day, and they're somewhere. There's thousands and thousands of people watching fireworks in Tokyo, and I think that that kind of scope, that kind of worldwide influence of the Disney company and the Disney storytelling is what's represented in the book.
And what an incredible book it is. It's on sale everywhere now. Would make a great Christmas present. I think there's time last minute to grab one before the holidays. Bruce, if we're going to put a link to the book in the show notes of this episode, but is there a place where people who might be interested in you and your story to connect with you and follow along with what you have going on?
I'm on Twitter. I'm not hard to find on Twitter. And otherwise, I do have a website, but it's a movie review website called AshevilleMovies.com. You can find me there. And I also want to encourage people to not only read the book, but to watch the related Disney Plus documentary series that covers all the same cast members. So in addition to being a beautiful book, it's a really fascinating documentary series that overlaps with the book that provides additional content. It's like the book has DVD extras, only it's on Disney Plus.
I love it. Bruce, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been fun.